Oh, well. Anyway, so this is chapter, this is a review for test number 4. It's going to be chapters 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 29. At any rate, so we're working on. We're going to end with, I think it's amino acids.
What if we do? What if we see here?
I know we have.
So whatever we whatever we do on Monday, because the test is on Tuesday, is that right? Yeah. So I probably will get a little ways into tomorrow, and then we'll stop the test. Stop the test at that point. Oh, you want to do any amino acids?
No.
Well, I can tell you that. Okay. Well, let me just say if he. All right. So we want. All right. Fine. We won't do any amino acids. But you have to take amino acids seriously when we go over them on Wednesday, and I may even ask you to show up on Thursday, because there's actually 3 or 4 questions on the fine on the standardized final about amino acids. Yes. We certainly can. That'd be nice. Yeah, we'll do our best. Now, have you downloaded? Have you gotten the old standardized test? Have you gotten that big semester review sheet? Yes.
What year is that test? Have
yes, that one's a pretty old one. It's the it is 1985. It's about they only they take a long time to retire a test. And so, yeah, that's about, I think there's one newer, but that one's about as new as we're going to get and still, because we can't, even though there's a 2003 that's available, which I have, which is 2007, which I've ordered, I still haven't figured out which one I'm probably going to use. I think I'm probably going to use the 2003 one even yet. But the next previous one is like 1997 or something. It's every 6 or 7 years. This is, they don't make new tests every year.
So you can use 2007, 3 or 97, is that what you're saying?
I don't know. I have choices of 2 standardized tests. One will be 2003, the other is now 2007. I just ordered. I haven't decided which one I'm going to choose yet. So I'm probably going to do 2003, but it doesn't matter to you because unless you, I mean, it doesn't matter. Yeah.
My question is, are there the answers to the test you gave us? Is that available?
Yes, it's on Moodle.
On Moodle?
Yeah, the answers are on Moodle. I even have you skip some that are so out of date and quaint that you don't even need to worry about some of the questions. Okay, what else? I'm actually not going to be here for the final, which is on the 11th. Will have to be proctored by somebody else. But that's okay. You guys can handle it. And we'll give you more arrangements, tell you more about those arrangements in a little bit, a little later on this week. Because I've got a presentation in California. Yes?
I think it's on the 12th.
Is it on the 12th?
Yeah.
Oh, I leave on the 11th. Yeah, it's on the 12th. 7:30 in the 12th. Right. 7:30 in the morning. Any other questions? All right. Let's see here. What you really want to know, in essence, is sort of what you need to focus on. So I'm going. Do you have all these notes here? Okay. All right. Well, let's just cut to the chase. And so on overhead, this is chapter 15, overhead number 1. You will not have a question that asks you to regurgitate this chart. Okay, there will not be a metabolic quiz type question that's based on this particular chart that you see here. However, there will be questions that deal with the fate of pyruvate, especially, that you see here, that will probably go into more detail than what you see here. All right. Now, overhead number, this is actually overhead number 3 in this. What you are going to find here is just you need to be able to tell me in general how glycolysis is divided. I also want you to tell me how hexokinase and glucokinase work together to regulate glucose concentrations in the blood. So that's A through F, or A through E, on overhead number 3. I would recommend that you read the text in this. It will be identical to what I will tell you now, and I'm not going to spend the time to review it. Now, you're going to find, of course, we have overhead number 4 is the pathway. You will not find any metabolic pathway questions about glycolysis. I'm not going to ask you to regurgitate that. The key here is going to be regulation of phosphofructokinase 1. This is overhead number 5. You need to be able to be aware of the inhibitors and activators and have a metabolic logic as to why. I also want you to focus especially on F26P, which is also identical to F26BP. It probably should be a B in front of that, in this indicating 2, but I have it listed as 2,6-phosphate. But F26P and F26BP are identical. Please relate this chart and 2,6-BP to the last diagram, last overhead, in chapter 15. Okay. Which dealt, if you would want to go ahead, we'll skip ahead and look at that last overhead. This is overhead number 22. This was entitled Regulation of Glycolysis by Glucagon. And so please relate that chart to this. And I think we've gone over this in detail. I think we spent a good 15-20 minutes reviewing this in class. But again, you know, unless you have specific questions, I will be available tomorrow afternoon for questions if you need. In addition, yes?
A question on this one. When your activators, you have AMP and cyclic AMP listed. Is that correct?
Yes, that is actually correct.
Okay, but then, so cyclic AMP is both inhibiting and an activator for PFK? Because in the pathway you just told us to talk about, cyclic AMP is what causes the D.
Right,
so
it does take a look.
So this has both roles.
High levels of cyclic AMP. Shift it down there, turn that off. What I will want you to do, let's actually do something intelligent with this. I'm going to format this differently. Font. Let's strike through the cyclic AMP.
Okay.
Let's clarify that and let's strike through that. I would prefer to focus on the most powerful of the activators, which is F26BP. That will be the question you'll be seeing on this test, and that will be the questions you will find on any standardized test will be the effect of F26BP.
Okay.
Yes?
Well, it does list AMP in the book.
Yes, it does list AMP. Yeah, but it does not, I don't think it lists cyclic AMP directly, does it?
No.
Yeah. So just strike through it. Yeah. So, the TIM, that's an interesting question. The flexible loop stereo electronic control, you'll need to be aware of that at least. And the reason why there's that flexible control. On overhead number 6, none of the diagrams that you see there, even the TIM enzyme intermediate, none of those will be regurgitated. You will not need to know that per se. Next, on overhead number 7. Oh, and let me emphasize one thing about this, and that is let me find that. Well, if you recall, actually, Okay, overhead number 7. Everything on here is eligible. This is a very nice series. This is nice, compact, slides. I can make all my slides. This book is going to be great. Get lots of good information about 2,3-BPG and its role in hemoglobin, oxygen transport, and also products. And then we introduced in the idea of homolactic formation, fermentation, and alcoholic fermentation. Overhead number 8, there's nothing, everything on overhead number 8. There's simply, the details here are very important. Homolactic fermentation. On overhead number 9, the writing of it, the text of it is important. But you look here, there is a diagram that describes the oxidation or reduction of NAD and NADH, the mechanism or the products or reactants of this particular reaction are not crucial in terms of their actual structure. So you will not need to regurgitate this. I do need you to know that if you take pyruvate and you reduce it with NADH, you make NAD plus, and you get lactate. Lactate is the reduced cousin to pyruvate. And please don't ever forget that they are intimately related. Overhead number 10. Boy, I'll tell you, there's everything on overhead number 10, including the diagrams. They will be eligible for questions on overhead number 10. Overhead number 10. Overhead number 11. Let's parse this. If you see under pyruvate carboxylase, it requires the coenzyme TPP. And notice under there, there's a C, there's a 1, 1, C, and then there's 1, 2, 3 right here. The 1, 2, 3, I'm not going to ask any questions about on the test coming up. I'm talking about 1, 1, 1, lowercase I, C, and 1, 2, 3.
So
hold on. Okay. Right. These specific pieces of information right here, I'm not going to ask about. You will need to know them for the final, however. They show up on the ACS final. So, I know everybody's finally paying attention now that there's a test going on. But anyway, and then right here you see the 2A. A through I, okay? And that's an important detail for nutrition, but I'm not going to ask any questions about beriberi in terms of its symptoms, okay? Just in general, what is the vitamin that's missing if you're getting beriberi? Okay? Now, everything else on that, okay, everything else, I will be considered eligible for asking questions on the test. Okay? Is that clear? Okay, excellent. I'm glad. That's clear. That was overhead number 11. Overhead number 12, I think we just said skip.
Yes.
Yeah.
Overhead number
10,
do you need to know the structures?
Yes. Yes, you actually, if you recall, this is one of the structures I asked you to write out for that list of structures. Actually, what I want you to know is not necessarily regurgitate this, But in a matching question of other cofactors, I want you to be able to identify this as thiamine or thiamine pyrophosphate. But to actually regurgitate the structure from memory, no. Yes?
Would you expect us to know any of the other factors from...
Yes, what I need for you to do, you should have gotten that back. Is that correct? That homework assignment that dealt with that? Yeah. Certainly for the final, I want you to review those structures. That's what I want you to do. Those this, the homework structures I had you do, please, you'll discover that you'll be glad that you did.
But also for the test?
Not this test, no. Whatever structures I ask for this test, I mean, this, yeah, we have a long ways to go. I'll tell you exactly what you need to know in terms of the structures. But the homework structures will be definitely something you need to know for the final. And please, if you see friends and family that are not here, especially families like your moms, make them sure, be aware that they need to memorize that homework sheet. Okay. Anyway. Mom, that's not biotin. What? Oh, man. Where am I here? Gone through this already. I think we're at number 12. I skipped already. Is that correct? I'm already going to skip that. The Pasteur effect. You need to be able to tell me what the Pasteur effect is. This is the increased use of glucose by yeast when there's no air available, no oxygen, because the only energy is going through glycolysis to pyruvate. There's no electron transport system available. Therefore, you have to consume a lot more glucose to get the same energy, the same number of ATPs. Now, on overhead number 13, again, there are these two, the table and the figure, you will not need to memorize. However, I do need for you to understand, in general, if I give you another chart like this, of perhaps a fake series of metabolic reactions, would you be able to tell me which ones would be most likely to be controlled? The ones that have the greatest loss of free energy. That's correct. That's the principle I want you to take away from this, is that, yes, this is the actual data, but the principle is control occurs at chemical reactions with high free energy release. And you can take that to the bank, and you can take that to medical school and graduate school, etc., etc. All right, now, the PFK regulation. Here is, again, there's everything on overhead number 14 you need to be able to know and be able to answer questions about. Overhead number 15, the fetal cycle, how it produces excess heat that is actually used to keep you warm. Overhead number 16, ladies and gentlemen. Now, there are important pieces here that I want you to know is these simple monosaccharides, these four, I need for you to tell me, and I hate to do this, but actually memorize it, where it enters into the glycolytic pathway. Galactose enters in as glucose-6-phosphate, mannose and fructose, and that depends on the tissue. Fructose in the liver enters as GAB. Beyond that, of course, then you have these complex diagrams down on overhead number 16. I did not ask you to memorize this. However, I did point out this particular material, the glycerol that's related to fructose. And what did I say about this glycerol right here? Yeah, that's the three carbon backbone from fat enters here if you're going to break it down, or leaves from here to go make fat from fatty acids. Now, the galactose on overhead number 17, the galactose and mannose, what I want you to know, of course, is that galactose goes through an intermediate called UDP galactose, which is acted upon by that enzyme that I like the name of. I apologize for picking something out of the air that you like the name of, but the name of that UDP galactose 4-epimerase, the fact that there is a epimerase, is it simply changing the stereochemistry around one carbon atom, changes it from galactose to glucose,
And of course, ultimately the output here is glucose 6-phosphate. Mannose, you don't need to worry much about mannose, except of course you know where that comes in and the glycolytic pathway. In other words, right here, the mannose, the fructose 6-phosphate, that's really all you need to know, even for overhead number 17. Number 18, what? I want you to know all the information on overhead number 18, but you do not need to memorize the chemical, balanced chemical reactions here. Okay, you can skip those. You need to, of course, know that you start off with three glucoses at the start of this, and then the stoichiometry works out. And, of course, stage one and stage two, what those mean, what they are. Now, overhead number 19, you will, this, of course, I asked you to do as a metabolic pathway. You will not see this as a metabolic pathway. Okay? You need to know the control of it, and you need to understand the importance of glutathione in adding antioxidation as an antioxidant in the cells, especially in red blood cells. So overhead number 20, everything needs to be known there. What does overhead number 21 do? Well, this is a nice summary. It tells you the fates of the different things. I'm not going to ask you to memorize this per se, but you need to know that the non-oxidative part of the pentose phosphate pathway can make ribuloses from GAP and fructose 6-phosphate. That there's that reversible section.
Can you say that one more time? Just to reverse.
Yeah, the fructose 6-phosphate and GAP can reversibly be made into xylose and ribose 5-phosphate, which goes on to nucleotide. So, in other words, there's parts of it that are reversible, and if the body does not need any DPH, but it does need nucleotides, backbones for nucleotides, then that second stage is reversible. That second part of the pentose phosphate pathway is reversible. Okay, overhead number 22, everything about overhead number 22, easily could ask, I need you to know this well enough that if I ask if something breaks, what's going to happen? If the phosphate, for example, that is this, the serine that's supposed to have the phosphate attached to it is somehow chemically modified so it doesn't accept the phosphate and doesn't change the conformation. You know, what's going to happen to glycolysis versus gluconeogenesis? So the questions are going to be pretty much what if. So you need to basically memorize this chart, and I think I did. Is this a metabolic pathway? Now, this one you're going to see, but more importantly, you're going to be asked questions about this one in detail. All right, so let's take a look at 16. And glycogen metabolism. Now, I'm now on overhead number 16. This is overhead number 3. Basically, I just want you to know the structure of glycogen and why it's highly branched. How do they describe the bonds that do the branching? The branching bonds are described as alpha what?
1,6.
And the linears are described as, you can have, in glycogen, you can have 10 million non-reducing ends. There's always only just one reducing end. Only one. Okay? This is this one on overhead number 4. What I want you to know, all the entire sum of complex carbohydrates that you can actually consume for digestion eventually gets broken down into 2, 3, maybe 4 monosaccharides. So all these complex carbohydrates, the starches and the glycogens and the sucroses and the lactoses, they all eventually get broken down into simple monosaccharides that enter in. And there are transporters for that. That's basically what I need for you to know out of this. I don't need for you to... Well... I need for you to know what an alpha-lipodextrin is, right? And I need for you to know what the role of lactase and sucrase is. And I need for you to tell me what happens if you don't have enough sucrase enzyme on the interior of your interior intestine. Overhead number 5, this is a pretty picture. I'm not going to ask you any questions about overhead number 5. Other dietary carbohydrates. Overhead number 6, the glycogen breakdown or glycogenolysis. The details of glycogen phosphorylase. You need to know all of this. All of this. On overhead number 7, you need to understand, you need to tell me how the glycogen debranching enzyme operates. That's the top one, that's the top figure. The glycogen debranching enzyme has how many activities? 2. One of them is to, one of them is to take that limit branch and tack it on the end. There's that transferase. And the second enzyme activity is to break that 1,6 bond into a single monosaccharide, and then you have nothing left but linear chains. So the debranching enzyme has 2 activities. Once the glycogen phosphorylase actually produces what monosaccharide? G1P. But glycolysis uses what? Yeah, and so you have to have that conversion, which you notice that mutase. And anyway, so it's an interesting situation with that. So overhead number 7, you need to know in detail. Overhead number 8, oh my goodness, again, this is death by a thousand details, and you need to know everything here. The T and the R form, and the glycogen branching enzyme, and the pyrophosphorylase high energy, and the glycogenin as a protein. The branching enzymes. Overhead number 9 on chapter 16. Oh, the branching enzyme here, where you have these long chains that create new branches. I'm not so worried about that. It's the phosphorylase kinase and the calmodulin. It's this diagram on overhead number 9 that I'm concerned about. If you recall, I think I said PP1, the last 4 or 5 lines on this overhead number 9, we are going to skip. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Right, so you have that.
Question?
Yes.
With the alpha, beta, and gamma, do you want us to memorize all of those, like, how each is a different site? Or did you just want us to memorize it?
Well, you know what? Memorize it. You know, I'm going to be nice to you because you have so many chapters to go over. Okay. So, what I need for you to do is, you know that there are 4 subunits. There is a delta subunit, and the delta subunit is calmodulin. And what do we know about calmodulin? It binds to calcium and allows calcium to act as a second messenger. So the delta in this particular enzyme, the phosphorylase kinase, is a calmodulin that then makes this phosphorylase kinase sensitive to calcium concentrations. And that's an excellent question. If you have this in your muscle cell, and this is sensitive to calcium concentration, I wonder why that might work that way. Is calcium involved in muscle contraction?
All right, overhead number 10. I believe I said skip on this particular overhead, this one. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. Glycogen phosphorylase. Oh, my goodness. Here this is. This is a beautiful combination. This is a paradigm. The reason why I've asked you, I know why you picked this particular one out of all the others, is because it demonstrates unambiguously that a single enzyme can have both allosteric control and covalent modification. Or allosteric control and covalent modification. What molecules here are related to the allosteric control? ATP, ANP, and glucose, is that correct? And then what are the ones which ones are the ones related to the covalent control? The phosphorylase kinase and the phosphatase. The phosphorus is being the phosphate is being added as a covalent material. Do the thickness of these arrows have any significance?
Yes.
Yes, please say yes. That is their tendency. So when the glycogen phosphorylase is phosphorylated, it tends to be active. But does it have to be active? If there's high levels of glucose, the allosteric. Yeah. Thank you. Very nice to hear that. Shifts it back to the inactive. So it's a very it's a complex control. And honestly, we were surprised how complex it was, given the relatively simple nature of it. But it is, like I said, a paradigm for other types of control. You will discover that when you get into your graduate work. Overhead number 12 on chapter 16, there's absolutely everything. You know, honestly, I don't think I'm going to ask you to memorize and regurgitate this, fill it out. But I can tell you that there'll be some high point questions about what if. What if the inhibitor becomes inactive? What's it going to do to the amount of glycogen in the cell? What happens if the phosphorylase kinase becomes inhibited because of a genetic problem or a disease? What's that going to do to the level of glycogen? Because if you recall here in the middle, these two, this is a pool of enzyme that's making glycogen. This is a pool of enzyme over here that's breaking it down. They're constantly being modified instantaneously almost, instant by instant, determining how much glycogen should be in your cells. So, again, that is a very powerful piece of information. Overhead number 13. This one is sort of a show and tell. I'm not going to ask you to memorize this. I need for you to be aware of the logic of this. Of course, here we have liver and muscle. The liver and muscle are both sensitive to insulin. What about glucagon? Is muscle cell apparently sensitive to glucagon according to this model?
No,
not particularly. Although I think it does have some sensitivity. We see here, of course, with epinephrine that it is sensitive to both. I need for you to tell me what's going on at the cellular level when insulin is at a high level versus, say, epinephrine at a high level. The two actually have opposing effects. And I want you to tell me what those opposing effects are and what metabolic pathways are altered. So, am I going to make you regurgitate this? No, but I need for you to know what insulin does in muscle cell and liver cell, and what epinephrine does in muscle cell and the liver cell.
What do you mean when you say insulin acts on the liver and muscle tissues differently?
Acts on? Did I say it acts on liver and muscle cell differently?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, actually, I misspoke, and I apologize for that. What actually happens is that insulin acts on both the same. Both of them require glycogen synthesis. It's the contrast between epinephrine and insulin. And I apologize for that. So the epinephrine, this is an interesting one. If you look at epinephrine, how does epinephrine differ?
Well, if you look very quickly, and I don't want to get deep into this, the epinephrine lands on a particular receptor that increases in muscle cells cyclic AMP, which leads to glycogen degradation and then to glycolysis. Over here, it does apparently the same thing. Epinephrine lands here, increases cyclic AMP, glycogen degradation, but this goes to glucose and then that's dumped in the blood. Okay. So, the effect, what?
So, you meant to say glycogen, I'm sorry, epinephrine acts on motor muscle cells.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Can epinephrine cause the muscle cell to release glucose into the bloodstream? No, it cannot. Primarily because the muscle cell is missing one enzyme of gluconeogenesis. Can someone tell me what enzyme that is? There's one enzyme that muscle cells are missing. Or else they could do this. It's the last one before glucose. Which one was that? Glucose 6 what? Glucose 6 phosphatase. So muscle is missing glucose 6 phosphatase. And therefore is doomed never to release glucose into the blood. Now, caution, you're going to get to graduate school and they're going to tell you, as I'm going to tell you now, muscle will release glucose equivalents. It can release lactate. It can release alanine, which are three carbon precursors to glucose. But in terms of the actual glucose, it will not release glucose. Unlike the liver cell. All right, that's over at number 14. Over to 13, over at number 14, everything here, especially review, again, the structure of biotin, please make sure that you're able to match that with its name, the four enzymes of glycolysis, the four horsemen, the fundamental one is this pyruvate carboxylase. And I just want to emphasize pyruvate carboxylase because notice what does it make? An oxaloacetate is an important intermediate in what other pathway? So pyruvate carboxylase is known as an anaplyretic enzyme. It builds up the intermediates of the citric acid cycle. So pyruvate carboxylase has a lot of role to play in keeping the citric acid cycle going as materials are drawn off from it. So pyruvate carboxylase plays a large role in the production of citrate, produces a lot of large role in the production of amino acids, plays a large role in the production of hemoglobin. Because pyruvate carboxylase increases the net amount of oxaloacetate, which, if you recall, goes all the way around, hits the succinate, and you can bring off the heme units, the porphyrins, from succinate, from the citric acid cycle. So this overhead number 14 is very important. Overhead number 15, well, what did the okay, so... What are you transporting between, this is gluconeogenesis. Of course, gluconeogenesis means that you've got, gluconeogenesis occurs within the cytosol, and yet much of the oxaloacetate is produced within the mitochondria, so there's a transport mechanism. You don't need to memorize this, okay? So overhead number 15 simply seems to tell you about the transportation of these intermediates from one site to another. The overhead, the next on that same page, there's a diagram that deals with how gluconeogenesis gets around the control points of glycolysis and the different enzymes involved with that.
Overhead number 416, does that look familiar again? Yes. And so should this pathway here, this logic right here. You need to be able to tell me how this works and why it works based on this diagram. Okay. And being able to tell me about this and tell me what happens if things are altered is in fact a critical thinking skill. Okay. So there's going to be some critical thinking questions about the diagram here on overhead number 16 as well as the list of events on overhead number 16. Biochemistry is a strange combination of very high-level questions and memorization, which, memorization has been accused of being the lowest level of learning, and I suppose in some ways it is. But there is no way to be able to predict what the next reaction on a pathway would be from fundamental principles. Glycolysis could not have been invented by a human being thinking about it. I mean, there are so many different ways of going with glycolysis, and yet glycolysis is so interdependent with other pathways. It had to be made simultaneously. Okay, sort of the irreducible complexity argument, actually. So, what does this describe here? Overhead number 17 is describing what? Creating some sort of glycoprotein. What kind of glycoproteins is it demonstrating? And how can you tell? Was it? If the glycoproteins are being attached to an asparagine side chain, that means it's what? N-linked. If it's being attached to a serine or a threonine, that means it's what? O-linked, because of the alcohols on those side chains. This is an N-linked glycoprotein. The other sure way you know that it's an N-linked glycoprotein is because in the presence of, what does it show up here? It doesn't really show up. This little strange little molecule, this lipid that's got these phosphates on it, it's called dolichyl phosphate. And the presence of dolichyl phosphate only exists in N-linked glycoprotein production. And it is the carrier that holds the forming complex carbohydrate until the entire complex is transferred in toto from the dolichyl phosphate to the asparagine of the growing polypeptide chain. And of course, we're at 18. There's nothing there. Is that correct? Say no. Let's take a look at number 17 then, I think is next. I'm going through, I'm using a keynote simply because we've had trouble with the needing to be repaired. Overhead number 17, ladies and gentlemen. This is slide number 2 on overhead 17. What I need for you to know is the sources of fuels for glycolysis and the fate of the products of citric acid cycle. So the fuels, the main units, main molecules for the citric acid cycle, and the final outcome, the product of the citric acid cycle. So pyruvate from glycolysis, fatty acids from mitochondria, and amino acids from the urea cycle, but these, of course, have had their nitrogen stripped. It's actually the amino acid skeletons. Amino acid skeletons. There's no urea in the citric acid cycle. I'm not going to ask you to summarize the number of ATP produced in one form or another. I think you probably did that in Foundations of Biology.
So yes. Basically, it's that graph, that leftmost graph, the rightmost graph. Right?
It would be this rightmost graph. Would be the most effective way of committing it to memory. Although the rightmost graph doesn't show the NADHs and the FADs that are coming off, or the GTPs, or even the carbon dioxide. My main concern for the memorization of the metabolic pathways in this test is mostly the regulatory pathways.
So here this is the diagram itself. I'm not so much worried about. I really want you to know about the anabolic. Oh, in the material here, any of the text is going to be eligible for questions. Like I said, I'm not going to remember ask you to regurgitate any of the citric acid cycle. All of overhead number four, even, and I hate to do this to you, but even this list, the cofactor list, right here.
Just not just the location option.
Actually, I'm going to be very crass about this and say no.
So just basically...
just the list of the cofactors, which are related to the vitamins and stuff. This primarily would be not for this test, but this list will be for the standardized final. This is the list under table 17.1 for those of you listening at home. Now, that's this list right here on the table. At the bottom of overhead number four, there's a list of the cofactors. There's five of them, and what their purpose is. And that would be eligible for questions on this test. Is it basically the same thing?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, great. All right, well, you could avoid all worrying about this if you would sort of put this, if you would put this to memory, the E1, the E2, and the E3. That might be very helpful, primarily not just to memorize it per se, but for the regulation of it, which is going to be on the next page. I'm concerned primarily with the regulation of pyruvate dehydrogenase. And that comes here on overhead number 5. So I need for you to know everything there is to know about overhead number 5 on chapter 17. Overhead number 6. This one, of course, you can summarize here is that the citric acid cycle is primarily regulated by NADH concentrations. The higher the NADH concentrations, the slower the reaction moves. The reason why it's just so broadly regulated is that because so many other pathways intersect with it, then it's basically always on. Fats are brought off from this through citrate. Succinyl-CoA makes all the porphyrins for the hemoglobin. Amino acids come in alpha-ketoglutarate. They leave at alpha-ketoglutarate. So the citric acid cycle does not have the same fine-tuned regulation that you find in the glycogen phosphorylase. That wasn't mine, was it? Okay. Now, I need for you to know the fates here on overhead number 7. The diagram is helpful to memorize in terms of your own education. I need for you to, it should relate pretty closely to what's listed here in the text. And again, the bottom line here is this pyruvate carboxylase, which is that antipyretic reaction chemistry which provides the carbons necessary for the citric acid cycle to be used as a source for all those many other things. The glyoxylate cycle. The glyoxylate cycle on overhead number 8, you do not need to memorize the figure here. However, I do want you to know the two, or at least know the names of the two unique enzymes that are involved with the glyoxylate cycle. And what are those names? And malate synthase. And what do they actually avoid according to the text here? These two enzymes that allow the carbons to skip the loss of carbon dioxide. This is the citric acid cycle, except these two things skip the chemical reactions that lose carbon dioxide. And you need to know why this occurs in seeds. And why it does not occur in you. Well, you know why it doesn't occur in you. You are not a seed unless you have a cotyledon.
Yeah, some parchment, some spring days, I sometimes think I should have a colleague come out to enjoy the sun. Number overhead number 18, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. Number 2 on overhead number 18, slide number 2. Slide number 2. There is, the idea here is that the inner mitochondrial membrane is impermeable to everything. And this is just an example of some of the transporters that are required. You do not need to memorize the figure.
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time? The
inner mitochondrial membrane is impermeable to virtually everything. That's why there's so many different transporters.
We found some, because in the book, or just looking at it, and then on page 620, does it say here that, and I'm just slightly confused,
on your
to virtually everything except hydrogen ions.
Oh, yeah. On page 6, so note that the inner membrane space is topologically equivalent to the cytosol, because the outer mitochondrial membrane is permeable to the lot.
Oh,
you say here that the outer
mitochondrial membrane. Oh, I know. I say it's impermeable. That must be something new. Sorry. That's okay. Well, then just cross that out. Thank you for pointing that out to me. So permeable to everything, and so you see where here it says except hydrogen ions. For the please, come on, here we go. No, I want to do this to it. Okay, so it's everything, and we go up here into format. And font and strike through. So just strike through that. But that makes sense. But why don't the hydrogen ions then just simply diffuse away after they get pumped?
That's what we want to ask.
Well, do you recall? It's the same. Do you remember? It's the exact same effect that you find with bacteria. When bacteria pump protons and they're in a watery environment, those protons don't diffuse away either. What you find is that very thin membrane acts like a dielectric material. Dielectric material. And so as you pump the protons from the interior to the exterior, what happens to the relative charge in the interior? It becomes negative, and essentially you find negative ions begin to line up closely across next to there. And due to the dielectric nature, insulation nature of the membrane, the hydrogen protons sense this negative charge and gather right at the surface. And so you end up having something that looks like, and I think I said this already before, a charged capacitor, where you have the positive charges here, you have the negative charges here, and then you have the plasma membrane, and the membrane right there. So the dielectric constant simply allows the sensation of these electrons to be transferred or sensed across that gap, and the protons then sense that and stay physically close to it. That's why they don't diffuse away. Essentially, you're creating a capacitor right there, according to physics. Do you remember physics? Remember that in physics?
Do we need to be able to explain that?
Well, no. I'm not going to ask that about capacitance and dielectric constant. It's just some free information that you shouldn't forget in case you ever run across a question that asks that or asks something similar. Okay, so I've asked you to... there's a couple of transporters here. Overhead number 3, I'm not going to ask you to memorize the transport mechanisms that you see there. Overhead number 4... Actually,
I'm sorry, so for 4, we should know, for overhead
number 3,
you should know the different types of transporters.
You should be aware that there are different types of transport, correct?
Just aware.
Right, just aware. Am I going to ask you questions about monocarbox? I don't know, I am. There's so much other stuff I have to ask. Let me just say not probably, because that's not fair, is it? I am not going to ask questions about the monocarboxylate or the tricarboxylate transport.
No, but no and no. Of course, immediately that means you forget anything you ever knew about it. Okay, so you see these other two transporters that you see here, the Malley-Descartes shuttle and the alpha-glycerol phosphate shuttle. The details of these, as described on the other pages, you see, because I think this diagram here relates to the next page text section. I don't need for you to know the details 1 through 7 or 1 and 2. I do need you to know that the Aspartate-Malley shuttle transfers electrons without energy loss. I think I said that when I lectured about it. And also that the alpha-glycerol phosphate shuttle, in fact, does transport electrons with energy loss, because it starts off as NADH, but it only produces FADH2, which we'll see is at a lower oxidation, a lower reduction potential, and thus at a lower energy. So the underlying pieces here are probably what I want you to link. Well, they are what I want you to link with the names of those particular shuttles. Now, where are those shuttles located in the cell? Where are those two shuttles located? In the inner mitochondrial membrane. Yeah, do not forget it. Over at number 5, again, this one's interesting, the citrate malate shuttle. This one is important because it produces citrate necessary for... Yes, shuttle.
Out of curiosity, is this the same thing as the tricarboxylate?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
It's not identical. Don't worry about the adenosine nucleotide translocator. Boy, doesn't it sound something out like out of Star Trek? Adenosine nucleotide translocator. Captain, the translocator's not working. All right. Overhead number 6, ladies and gentlemen. Everything on overhead number 6. You do not need to memorize the diagrams that you see there in terms of the reduction potential, either the top diagram or the bottom diagram. However, I need for you to have a mental picture of it and know that complex 1 accepts what reducing equivalents? And complex 2? FDH2. Okay. Please don't forget that. And you also must know, as I mentioned here, since it's in this text, it increases its importance, that what these individual complexes are inhibited by. That's a common question I ask as to why rotenone won't kill a mitochondria being fed succinate, but cyanide will kill a mitochondria being fed succinate. Then the chemiosmotic theory about what's going on with the ATP synthase and all that kind of thing, and talking about protons. You know, we could have spent an entire day looking at the biochemistry of the ATP synthase. I wish we had enough time for it. It's a marvelous machine of unbelievable creativity. Yes?
Do we need to know it as a first step slide 7?
Well, okay. What you need to know out of slide 7 is that complex number 5 is that ATP synthase I was bragging about. And that's where protons are allowed to come back into the matrix after they've been pumped. And the energy difference between the intermitochondrial membrane and the matrix is captured as ATP as it passes through that synthase. I mean, you know... All right, well, whatever. Okay, yes?
When we had done this night before, we had us draw in an uncoupler.
Yes.
Does that, which I understood, it basically makes
a hole in the intermitochondrial membrane.
Can they go either way according to where the concentration is?
Exactly right. The hole is agnostic. Whatever has the highest concentration, it can go, it'll allow the hydrogen ions to go down the concentration gradient, no matter what gradient it is.
Okay.
It's
and
just a hole.
So
right.
what like the purpose for that is so you can keep the cycle going even if something isn't working, or I mean,
in reality there is only one purpose of that hole, and that's to kill the cell. Okay, there's no useful purpose for a hole in the inner mitochondrial membrane that allows hydrogen ions to move freely either direction. If there's no medication, there's nothing that can happen good. It was simply a device used to verify the chemiosmotic theory.
You don't want a hole in your mitochondrial membrane. Ever, okay? Someone offers you a chemical that puts a hole in your mitochondrial membrane, just flat refuse. Tell them to give it to somebody else. Okay, now this particular model, this particular thing, overhead number 8, on chapter number 18, for those of you listening at home, again, I need for you to make sure that you understand the three charts and why they confirm the chemiosmotic theory. Why they confirm it. If you can't explain it to me or to a friend of yours, fax this to your mom and explain it to her. And once you can explain it to her so it makes sense, then you probably know it well enough for the test. Okay? Mom. All right, control of ATP production. I think I limited this pretty strongly. I believe I asked you to simply know the control allosteric effectors for the phosphofructokinase 1. Is that correct? And also, I believe it was a pyrimidine dehydrogenase. I believe those two were the only ones I asked you to commit to any kind of memory. All the text, of course, is important. But to commit to memory, you do not need to commit that diagram to memory. Just know why things get turned on, what things turn on and off. PFK1 and pyrimidine dehydrogenase. And the P-to-O ratio. P standing for ATP and O standing for oxygen. Some people say 2, some people say 3. Yeah. Okay, that's 18, and then we have now we're going on quickly to 19, I believe. 18, 19, 19, there's 19. Photosynthesis. Okay, now we're gonna hit the high points of photosynthesis here. I need for you to know where everything goes on in photosynthesis. Okay? Where does it happen in photosynthesis? Next, I want you to recall. Not the exact frequencies, but recall the light-absorbing pigments that can be found. And you'll find chlorophyll A, B, bacterial chlorophyll A and B, and then also phycoerythrin, phycocyanin, and carotenoids. All of them are chromophores that absorb light and can trap that light energy and use it for good. All right. Do you need to know the structures of chlorophyll versus protoporphyrin? No. You need to know this. You need to be able to reproduce that diagram of frequencies. No, you do not. Okay. Now, overhead number 4 in chapter 19. Everything on this you need to know. Everything on overhead number 9. Overhead number 4 on chapter 19. You need to know. And let's see here. Okay. And I'll go on. Everything on overhead number 5 as well. Please read the text as well in this. This is an interesting diagram. It has tremendous power. You're watching life occur, actually. Because without capture of light, life would not exist. Overhead number 6. All the text, of course, I need for you to be able to tell me about. Don't worry about the
the transport, this DCMU, I'm not going to ask any questions about it. The Z scheme for photosynthesis, what do I need to know out of this, Dr. Novak? You do not need to memorize this. I do, however, want you to link photosystem 2 with the production of oxygen. Link photosystem 2 to the oxygen evolving complex, which means link photosystem 2 to the manganese complex, which is a part of the oxygen evolving complex, which is the one that strips electrons away from water. Over here in PS2, you'll find that there are two things I want you to be aware of. Photosystem 2 has a non-cyclic pathway, which ultimately produces what? Which we know is almost exclusively used for. Then it also has a cyclic pathway, which can skip this production of NADPH. It can pass through into a pool, which is used for pumping of protons. So the cyclic pathway can be thought of as being used as a production of ATP. So cyclic allows electrons to pump protons, which means you're making ATP. The cyclic pathway is the production of ATP. The non-cyclic pathway is the production of NADPH. Overhead number 7. I do not want you to memorize any of this, of course. I mean, where are the protons being pumped when they're being pumped? Light comes in and protons are pumped. Where are they being pumped? By these electrons from the photon. The protons are being pumped from the stroma into the what? Thylakoid lumen, and the synthase is in the thylakoid lumen, allows the protons to return, and the stroma is actually where ATP is produced. And you should know that from the first slide in this. You should remember that. Otherwise, overhead number 7, do not memorize it, please. Overhead number 8, which deals with the oxygen evolving complex. Please have this chart roughly in your imagination. I'm not going to ask you to regurgitate it. I may ask you why multiple photon hits are required for oxygen to be evolved. I will not ask you any questions about this flash number question. In other words, why 3 flashes and then every 4 after that. I'm not going to ask you a question about that. Overhead number 19. Overhead number 9. There's a more complex scheme for plants. Same idea. Just know the text on this. Know the text. The dark reactions, overhead number 10. Yes, please. Okay. Overhead number 10. I love this slide. This tells me all about ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase and why we're all so totally dependent upon it. I need you to know everything. You do not need to memorize the chemical reaction here. You can skip that. But you do need to know that you're producing GAP from what the starting material in the dark reaction? Is it a 6-carbon compound or a 5-carbon compound? What's the starting material in the Calvin cycle? 5-carbon is ribulose, 1,5 bisphosphatase. That's why the enzyme is called ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxidase. So, this diagram I've not asked you to memorize. You will recognize much of it from the rearrangement that comes from the pentose phosphate pathway. You do not need to memorize this particular diagram either, except to circle the fact about how ribulose bisphosphate, carboxylase, and the Calvin cycle are regulated. If you return to days of yore, overhead number 10, the Rubisco responds to three light-dependent reactions. But FBPAs and SBPAs, which are part of the Calvin cycle, are also affected by light. So FBPAs and SBPAs are also affected by light. And you can see that right here. That in the presence of light, the phosphatases become reduced and active. In the dark, they become oxidized and inactive. So light is in more than one way required to occur in order for the Calvin cycle and the dark reactions to be turned on. Now here's that system in detail. You need to be aware of it, but you do not need to remember the regurgitate the graph on number 12. The text is what I'm looking for. What on overhead number 13, again, the actual graph is not required. However, the text, which describes what's going on with photorespiration, is. You need to know the concepts involved with photorespiration. C4 plant, again, this is overhead number 14. You do not need to know the diagram, but the concepts involved in C4 plants. Why C4 plants have an advantage in the tropical region, why C3 plants have an advantage in cooler regions or regions that have less sunlight. Why is that? And then the Crassulean acid metabolism has to do with the capturing of malate at night when the pores are open, allowing carbon dioxide into the plant. Surprisingly, it's hard to believe, despite everything that's said about carbon dioxide, the planet actually, in my opinion, would be healthier with a slightly higher level of carbon dioxide. Because, do you remember the parts per million that we were talking about? Remember that? What was it? The current part per million is 380 parts per million. Catastrophe will occur, according to Al Gore, if we reach 400. But he doesn't ever say that the minimum number amount of carbon dioxide for plant seeding is 200, and the minimum amount of carbon dioxide for plant existence. They die below 100. Okay. Digestion and absorption of dietary lipids, ladies and gentlemen. There's everything here you need to know. Overhead number 2 on this, the diagram. I will not ask you to regurgitate the diagram in overhead number 2. Overhead number 3, everything here. Overhead number 3, the diagram, no, I will not ask you to regurgitate that. Overhead number 4 on chapter 20, everything there. Details, details, details. Overhead number 5 is simply a visual diagram for overhead number 4. You do not need to memorize overhead number 5. If it helps you understand overhead number 4, that's fine. But you do not need to memorize it. What I need for you to be able to do, well, this is overhead number 6 that talks about, overhead number 6 is the characteristics and functions of the major lipoprotein. I want you to be able to tell me the relative densities here. What is the least dense lipoprotein that's listed here? Chylomicron. What is the most dense? Yeah. Chylomicrons, what's their origin? Chylomicrons exclusively come from your diet. That's what the fats get transported in when you eat them. The origin of the VLDL, IDL, and the LDL typically is the liver. And the HDLs are the extrahepatic tissues. Everything but liver. many times in the muscle cells and other cells, not adipose tissue so much. Although, you know, it is a mess to try to figure out exactly where all these things are and where they come from. Because look at all the different proteins they're attached to. And this is species dependent. These proteins are different for chimpanzees and for orangutans, our relatives. And they're vastly different for rats and mice. And so it's just a nightmare to try to figure out what's going on with glycoprotein. HMG-CoA reductase, as you know, is the control site for cholesterol. By the way, where is HMG-CoA made? Well, no, it's made... in what pathway makes it? Oh. HMG-CoA, what pathway makes it? You actually are making ketone bodies. It's ketone bodies that make HMG-CoA. And then the first committed step in the production of cholesterol is that HMG-CoA reductase. So that's why it's under such heavy control. Now, fatty acid oxidation, this is overhead number 8 on chapter number 20. This one, of course, I need for you to both, I mean, explain and have some level of understanding about the Franz Knopp, or Knoop, I think, experiments and how that they discovered it was being oxidized in units of 2. Fatty acid activation, its role in fatty acid metabolism. Fatty acid oxidation is a crucial first step. There's everything here on overhead number 9 you need to know. There are 2 figures on overhead number 9. You do not need to memorize these figures. You do not need to memorize the structure of carnitine. You recognize it as sort of a modification of an amino acid. Of course, carnitine, you need to know why, and that's actually in the text. So recall the text for you. Beta oxidation of saturated fatty acids. Now, this one is liable to show up on the test in terms of the metabolic pathways. If you recall, I hope I made this clear. If you recall the regulation of glycogen synthesis and breakdown, there was that pathway, that fairly complicated thing. That could show up on this as well. Did I mention that? The glycogen regulation pathway. PFK1, PFK2. Well, the one that's got the one that has in the middle, it's got glycogen phosphorylase and glycogen synthesis.
Yeah.
And it's got the dephosphorylation pathway and the phosphorylation pathway. I think I mentioned it. I just want to make sure that I did. This one will show up, but you remember, what was this? Did I ask you to know any of the structures? No, just the names, is that correct? And the names are likely to show up. I love this chemistry, though, but again, it all depends on the very first reaction, very first enzyme, which, of course, as you know, is my favorite enzyme, acetyl-CoA dehydrogenase. I don't know, what a geek, huh? That's my favorite enzyme. Overhead number 11. I'm not going to worry about anything in overhead number 11. Don't worry about anything in overhead number 11, except simply to admire the amount of ATP in one fat molecule. Oh. Wow. Metabolism of oxygen fatty acids. Everything on this page. However, you do not need... The concept that I need for you to know about cobalamin or vitamin B12 is that it is responsible as a cofactor in the enzyme that does a carbon skeleton rearrangement. The vitamin B12 is a cofactor in an enzyme that does carbon skeleton rearrangement from being branched to being linear. And that makes all the difference in the world. You wonder why, you know, couldn't God just have skipped that spot and just added the stuff to the end and you could have done it? I don't know. We'll have to ask.
You said from branch
to linear. What enzyme is responsible? What, and which of these three is got vitamin B12 with it? Okay, unsaturated fatty acid metabolism. Over at number 13, let's just, I'm going to skip that. Okay, it's a complicated thing. I need you to know, I mean, you know that it exists now, but I'm not going to ask you anything in detail about it. The fate of succinate, I do need for you to know. The production of malate back in pyruvate, blah, blah, blah. That you need to know. Over at number 14, by the way. Letter D there that says very long chain fatty acids. Don't worry about that. You can skip that part. Ketone bodies. I want you to know everything there is to know about ketone bodies. Number 15. Number 16. I think I asked you to memorize these overhead. These metabolic pathways. Is that correct in terms of their enzymes? I believe I did, didn't I? Yeah. Be prepared. They will probably, or they could show up as a part of this test. The production of acetone is pretty straightforward. It's just a spontaneous breakdown of acetoacetate. Fatty acid biosynthesis.
Sure.
Yes.
The enzymes you say should show up.
What?
You said these enzymes could show up. Which one are you talking about?
I'm talking about over there. I believe I asked you in the metabolic pathways to memorize this. Yeah, just the enzyme names, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah,
yeah, that could show up on
as a metabolic question.
Okay. Again, what's HMG-CoA? This is part of the ketone body production, but what else is it? It's the source of carbons for cholesterol. That's correct. HMG-CoA, that evil cholesterol, ladies and gentlemen. Fatty acid biosynthesis. You will not need to memorize this diagram. However, look at the types of separation on overhead number 18. I may ask you about the types of separation, the compare and contrast, these types of separation, physical location you'll need to be aware of, the electron carrier, the stereoform, the reactants and products, etc. You do not need to memorize the transportation process of this diagram. Suffice it to say, however, citrate is the material that's used as the precursor for fatty acid biosynthesis. Citrate. Okay, citrate gets broken down into acetyl-CoA. Acetyl-CoA then gets made into malonyl-CoA. Malonyl-CoA is actually the original material for the production of fatty acids. Everything on this page, number 19, over at number 19 on chapter 20, you'll need to know. Overhead number 20. Now, overhead number 20, I think, is a... Overhead number 20 has a diagram that dealt with, again... This is a metabolic pathway that I asked you to memorize. Is that correct? This could show up as a question on the test. So again, it's just the enzyme names. But I love the chemistry of it. Love the chemistry of it. It's just, you add oxidized carbon, you reduce it to water, you then remove the water to make a double bond, you reduce that double bond down to single bonds, and boom, you're on your way to a fatty acid. If you didn't eat any fatty acids at all, would you have any kind of metabolic issues? Would you be malnourished at all? That's a trick question, actually. If you didn't eat any fatty acids at all, you'd have trouble with... There is a fatty acid that is, in fact, an essential fatty acid. What is it? Anybody remember? We'll get to it eventually. What, linoleic acid, actually. I'm not going to ask, I hope you did that, but I'm not going to ask any questions about the overall stoichiometry of it, the role of ACP. Of course, what does ACP stand for? acyl carrier proteins. That's correct. Thank you. You can elongate it, and how do you make the unsaturated fatty acids? There are enzymes called desaturases. I will not ask you to know the rules and mechanisms of that desaturases. So on 21, overhead number 21, just the fact that there are desaturases to make the double bonds in a fatty acid, the rules and proportions and stuff are not going to be on the test. I did not give you any practice questions about it. Linolenic acid cannot be synthesized. It is therefore an essential fatty acid. The summary of fatty acid metabolism right here, you do not need to memorize it at all. I mean, it would be handy-dandy to know it. Keep things straight. You get confused, go to a diagram like that. And then this entire chapter can be hung on this diagram. Not the membrane lipids, well, maybe a little bit later. But the ketone bodies, the acetylcholine, the citric acid, the cholesterol, the fatty acids, the triglycerides, all this can be hung on this particular diagram if you get confused. I would almost use this as a learning tool to help keep things straight for yourself. Triacylglycerol biosynthesis, I think I asked you to skip this, is that correct? Or did we ask?
Yes.
I think there was one thing I had noted about. What was that? That was this thing right here, I think. What? That glycerol 3-phosphate, even that dehydroxyacetone phosphate, that came from the liver and that came from fructose, didn't it? So this is coming from fructose. That's interesting. Beyond that, I don't think I have to memorize it, so let's not worry about it. Overhead number 3. Number 24, regulation of fatty acid metabolism. Yes, indeed, everything on this. This diagram here, I want you to focus on the regulation enzymes. That means acetyl-CoA carboxylase, and also lipoprotein lipase and hormone-sensitive lipase. I need you to see, understand what's regulating them, how they are regulated allosterically, both in the adipose tissue and in the liver cell, both fatty acid biosynthesis and oxidation. Okay, so that diagram is very, very helpful to keep things straight. Cholesterol metabolism, very simple. What's the starting material for cholesterol metabolism? What's the first committed enzyme in it? Correct. And what is the target for all the statins? HMG-CoA reductase. That's the target for all those. Because it's the first committed step. Now, what else did I ask you to know? I wanted you to know that what? That HMG-CoA is the starting material, but one of the intermediates is what? Whenever you see isopentadiol pyrophosphate, think what? Cholesterol. Whenever you think of geranyl phosphate or pyrophosphate, what do you think? Geranyl pyrophosphate, I want you to think cholesterol metabolism. When you see farnesyl pyrophosphate, what do you think? Cholesterol metabolism. When you think of squalene, what do you think? I had, and I love her to death, but anyway, she was I had a girlfriend, as I was teaching at Union College. She was a chemistry major. She graduated from Union. But she was very health conscious. She wanted to keep her cholesterol levels low. And so she was taking lots and lots, I mean pills, of shark squalene. I said, now, let's think about this. And I gave her the textbook that you use, and I had her look up squalene and had her realize that squalene was the next compound on the way to what? Cholesterol. I said, you know, I'm not sure what shark squalene is going to do for you. It might suppress something, but there's, you know, we don't know that squalene will actually suppress the cholesterol synthesis. So she stopped taking it, and it saved her a bunch of money as well. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you tomorrow. Now, please come. There are some points available tomorrow at the end of this. Okay, we're going to go on to chapter 21, the amino acid section. very crucial for the final.
Thank you very much. I'll have this recording